This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, change, color, and confusion are in the air. Summer's over, the leaves are changing color, and the polling results on health reform are gyrating day by day, causing great confusion. Margaret, I think we're probably the most polled nation in the world. I know my phone's been ringing off the hook, and I've been trying to sift through the blizzard of data, but it's very confusing. It seems really to boil down to the way people ask those questions that determine so much the answers that we're getting.
Well, to parody a famous book, we could ask for whom the poll tolls, because in many ways it seems like there's an opinion for every poll and a poll for every opinion. But I think what is more important is it looks like this is a question of whether we've been able to communicate the facts and whether people have learned and remember those facts when they're asked whether they approve of the bill. It turns out that the more people understand the factual accuracy of the bill, the higher their approval ratings. And I think that means probably not such a good approval rating for how well those facts have been communicated to the public.
Well, this is certainly causing some consternation across the country. You know, the closer we get to election, opinion starts to become judgment. And the White House is really concerned that the judgment on health reform might be negative. And they're out very aggressively trying to clear the air and get some light on the facts. They have a new website, whitehouse.gov/health reform, where they really focus in on the myths and facts of health reform. They also do a state-by-state analysis of the impact on the law. Listeners can check that out on their website.
And that's a good idea, because the Kaiser Foundation poll, speaking of polls, found that confusion has risen to its highest since the bill passed 6 months ago. I find this hard to believe, Mark, but their results, 53% of Americans just don't understand what the new law actually means.
Well, the White House has an uphill fight, and we're going to be speaking today with someone from the White House, Tina Chen, who's the executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls, as well as the White House director of the Office of Public Engagement. We'll talk to Tina about the benefits to women and families under health reform. We're happy she can join us today.
And I think she'll be a great guest because she has a broad perspective on women and girls and issues of gender equality. But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes and get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you want to hang on to every word or read a transcript of one of our shows, visit us at chcradio.com. And think about becoming a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook or following us on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Tina Chen, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. Last week marked the six-month anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. Events were held across the country to promote new benefits that just kicked in. Vice President Joe Biden was tasked with addressing one of the more skeptical groups of the law so far, senior citizens. But he only had good news to share, something that seniors who fall into Medicare's prescription drug coverage gap will be happy about.
What we're doing with this new law, beginning in January of 2011, you will get 50% discount on all the prescriptions, including name brand prescriptions, that you have to pay for while you're in that donut hole.
The discount is expected to reduce Medicare's out-of-pocket costs by more than $2 billion in 2011. This summer, the federal government also sent out $250 rebate checks to Medicare beneficiaries who were affected by the coverage gap. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners released the much-anticipated draft of rules outlining how insurers must spend patients' medical care. The regulation will form the basis of the new requirement that most insurers use 85% of all premiums on medical costs, which will limit administrative expenses and profits for insurance companies. The industry is likely to alter the document. Regulators hope to finalize the rules at an October 21st meeting, and then the Department of Health will have the final say. Another anticipated document met the public's eye last week. The 21-page Pledge to America offers up the Republicans' plan for health care if they win control of Congress in this November's elections. The document proposes to do away with health care mandates on small businesses, allow the purchase of health care across state lines, and reform medical liability laws. Republicans, however, made no indication of repealing the Patients' Bill of Rights, the new benefits that kicked in to protect consumers. This week on Conversations, we're exploring women and healthcare. We all know that being obese is bad for your health, but new research finds that it's also burdensome to your wallet, especially for women.
For a woman who is obese, it costs $4,879 a year, and for an obese man, $2,646 more in healthcare costs and employment costs.
That's Christine Ferguson, co-author of a study released last week from George Washington University. Researchers measured the yearly costs of sick days for obese men and women, their lost productivity, even the need for extra gas in their cars because of extra weight. Ferguson plans to study why there's such a difference between the sexes in costs. One theory suggests that women earn less than skinnier women, while wages don't normally differ that much for overweight men. Looking at these costs may help policymakers weigh the value of spending to prevent and fight obesity. There's no question that obesity is both a health and economic concern for this country. Let's turn now to our interview with Tina Chen, who can tell us more about how women benefit under healthcare reform.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Tina Chen, Executive Director of the White House Council on Women and Girls and White House Director for the Office of Public Engagement. Welcome, Tina.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
You know, the White House Council on Women and Girls was set up by President Obama to make sure that cabinet-level agencies were considering how their programs and policies impact women and families. The president was very passionate at the signing ceremony last May. He said, so now it's up to us to ensure that our daughters and granddaughters have no limits on their dreams, no obstacle to their achievement, and that they have the opportunity their mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers never dreamed of. Tina, a great vision with the bar set appropriately high. Tell us how your office has tried to realize this dream in the context of healthcare reform legislation. And are you satisfied with what was included in the bill for women and families?
Thank you, Mark. And that is a great summary and reminder to all of us of the purpose of the Council on Women and Girls. Just a word about it. There has never been a White House Council on Women and Girls before. The members of the council are all of the cabinet-level agencies and all the major White House offices, and we did that to make sure that every agency and every office is considering the interests of women and girls in everything they do every day. And the Affordable Care Act is a good example of that. We worked together tirelessly with our Office of Health Reform all during the crafting of the bill, the passage, and now as we do implementation. And HHS and our partners in the other agencies are working tirelessly to make sure that the concerns of women and girls and their families are addressed.
Tina, September 23rd was a landmark day. It marked the six-month anniversary of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and many of its provisions went into effect. One of these is the requirement that new insurance plans provide a set of preventive health services, including women's health-specific services, at no cost to the patient. Now, the services tend to follow the United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, but in your conversations with women and women's organizations around the country, I'm sure other healthcare issues have come up. Access to contraception under insurance without out-of-pocket costs might be one of those, but I'm sure there are others. How is your office engaging in this process of determining what women's health services will be mandated for coverage now and down the road?
Thank you, Margaret. Great question. Under the terms of the statute makes reference to existing prevention standards or standards that the secretary may look at as they are developed. The existing standards that apply are the U.S. Prevention Task Force standards as it applies to women and the pediatric Healthy Start standards for children. And in addition to mammograms, if you let me just go through them a little bit, beyond mammograms and cervical cancer screenings, there is also now free, affordable preventive care services for obesity counseling, for blood pressure screening, for heart disease screenings, all of which are, again, diseases like diabetes and obesity and preventable diseases that women and especially minority women suffer at a greater rate than the population as a whole. In addition, there are healthy pregnancy screenings that are included already in the free prevention services. So screening for conditions like hepatitis B, RH incompatibility, special tailored counseling to help women quit smoking and avoid alcohol use during their pregnancies, counseling to support breastfeeding and to help nursing mothers. And of course, there are well baby and well child visits for their children and screenings to detect and treat common childhood problems like, again, obesity, depression among children, dental treatment, and annual flu vaccines. So there is a broad range of services that already come in. What I think you're referring to, Margaret, is there is not currently in existence a standard women's well health care list of prevention services. And the Department of Health and Human Services has already contracted with the Institute of Medicine to run a process over the course of the next year where they will take medical input on what kinds of services should be included in a women's health care preventive health care standard. Contraception will be one of the things they will look at. And that standard is due to be issued by next August.
Tina, that was a wonderful walkthrough about the health and health disparities that women face. And your office has been active in engaging women in conversations about many topics. From those discussions, what new approaches or ideas have you gleaned about how the federal government might try to improve health outcomes and reduce disparities for women and girls? And also tell us about your partnership with Secretary Sebelius on this and other health-related matters.
I mean, all during the healthcare process we've engaged in for the last year and a half, we have had conversations with women's organizations, with individual women. The First Lady hosted three events last summer and fall, focusing on women's health, on breast cancer, and on senior women and what they need. And we've really heard a lot about things like the disparity in what women paid for. You know, a healthy 23-year-old woman before the Affordable Care Act passed would pay more in premium by as much as 150% more than a healthy young man. That, there were eight states that still counted being in a domestic violence situation as a high-risk situation that allowed an insurance company to deny coverage to a woman. And there were insurance companies that counted pregnancy as a pre-existing condition. The National Women's Law Center actually ran a campaign calling being a woman is not a pre-existing condition because that's some of the things that women were experiencing. Those are a lot of the reforms that are directly taken on by the Affordable Care Act, and I'm really pleased to say that when the Act is fully implemented in 2014, no one will be able to be denied coverage because of pre-existing condition, whether that is pregnancy or otherwise, that gender, rating discrimination will be eliminated. And along the way, we'll be able to provide coverage to, 23 million more Americans who today don't have coverage. Again, a majority of whom are women and their children.
Tina, in the last few weeks, we've been hearing quite a bit about the United Nations Millennium Development Project goals. And as I've listened to some of these discussions, it was clear to me that they're similar in many ways to the focus of the Office of Women and Girls, improving the economic life of women, improving health and health care, and ending violence against women. A general recognition around the globe that as the health of women goes, so goes the health of the society. I wonder if you could share with us any innovations that you're seeing globally in women's health issues that you think might offer promise here in the U.S. And is your office working with any aspect of the Millennium Development Goals Project?
Oh, yes, we are. Our office really works through all of the federal agencies. So we, the State Department and Ambassador Milan Revere, the first ever ambassador on global women's issues at the State Department, and Ambassador Susan Rice at the UN are also, partners with us. I was in New York last week along with Valerie Jarrett, the chair of the Council on Women and Girls. We were both participating in different aspects of the Clinton Global Initiative session and the Millennium Development Goals Summit. We, in fact, through the Council on Women and Girls, co-chaired an event, a breakfast meeting, together with the Millennium Challenge Corporation, where we directly talked with a number of stakeholders around the world on how we can better integrate gender considerations as a daily part of how we address reaching the Millennium Development Goals. Because, and I think the President even acknowledged it in his speech at the summit last week, that you know, improving the lives of women and girls is really a key avenue to reaching the Millennium Development Goals, and it is a key avenue to achieving peace and stability around the world as well. That's another reason why, and I comment on this frequently because I think people don't know, that part of our national security strategy, which was issued earlier this year by the President, laying out all of the factors that we view as important to our national security, the improvement of the rights and lives of women and girls around the globe is specifically noted because we do know as we improve those lives, again, societies become more stable, more prosperous as they tap into that 50% of their population that is so often left behind.
Today we're speaking with Tina Chen, Executive Director of the White House Council on Women and Girls and White House Director for the Office of Public Engagement. Tina, First Lady Michelle Obama has structured a very strong and promising childhood obesity campaign with her Let's Move initiative, really engaging every sector of society, government, corporations, communities, and families. But what more do you think we can do to get the public engaged on the campaign to fight childhood obesity? This type of public engagement seems to be a natural fit for your other responsibilities that you have within the White House as the director for the Office of Public Engagement. Tell us about how this dialogue, if you will, with the American public is going. There's a lot of us, and increasingly, we're all using different mediums to communicate. It's an important task as you're trying to bring new voices to the table. Tell us how successful this initiative has been.
I think the initiative is going, you know, terrific. I mean, beyond even our wildest expectations when the First Lady sat down to learn about and tackle this issue a year ago. We have seen, as you point out, you know, people across the spectrum joining in, not just parents and kids in schools, but, you know, the food industry, the restaurant industry, chefs, the farm industry, agriculture, really all the various aspects of our society that affect the kind of food we have, the access to food that we have, so neighborhood development to address food deserts. All of these aspects are coming to bear in a terrific way to address this serious problem that, you know, leads to so many other preventable diseases and causes, you know, for children and families. We've been working together with the First Lady's office because, as you point out, my two roles here, in addition to the Council on Women and Girls, is as the Director of Public Engagement, which is our outreach office. So we have been working with the First Lady's office in reaching out to all of those sectors and bringing them all in and seeing them as part of this effort. It's something that we do on all of our initiatives here at the White House. Our charge from the President as being the Office of Public Engagement is to engage the public broadly in what we are doing, both so that they know what the administration is working on and that we get their input and participation in things like Let's Move, in things like job creation and what we're doing on the economy, on the Affordable Care Act, and things like Wall Street reform as well. All of those are things that touch the lives of the American people, and we really want people to stay engaged with us.
Tina, I'd like to go now to an issue that I know has been of interest to you over the years, is of interest to the First Family and to the Office of Women and Girls, and that's work-life balance. Certainly an area of great stress for women and families around the country, and nowhere more so than as seen in low-income families. The United States obviously does much better than some countries in this area, but also there's countries that are much more generous to families and to women, particularly in the first year or two after the birth of children. What can we look forward to coming forth from your office, either in legislation or social policy, that might reduce the stress and improve work-life balance for new families?
Well, Margaret, work-life balance has been a big issue for the President and First Lady. It's a priority for them, in part because it's something that they've lived as working parents themselves. We know that two-thirds of American children right now are living in a household where they are being raised either by a single parent or by two working parents. So it's an issue that we have to address. We had a forum here with the President and the First Lady in March of this year here at the White House to launch a national conversation on workplace flexibility. Our Council of Economic Advisors issued a report that day that shows not only is it important to do for our children and for our families, but it also helps the bottom line. Businesses that provide workplace flexibility to their workers reduce their costs and turnover. They reduce training costs for new employees. They have workers who are more productive and focused on their work when they're not having to also worry about their children or an elderly parent or even how to meet their religious observances with their schedules at work. So it really cuts across a whole vast array of our workplace and our workforce. So we launched the conversation. People can view excerpts from the forum at whitehouse.gov if you go to the Council on Women and Girls page. And you can also download from that website a WorkFlex starter kit so you can have your own conversation in your own community. And the Department of Labor will be launching conversations around the country, their first being later on this month, in October, in Texas, focusing on small businesses. And we plan to both continue that conversation around the country to get the private sector talking about how to implement this. And in the public sector, our Office of Personnel Management is spearheading pilot projects and efforts so that we in the federal government as an employer can walk the walk in addition to talking the talk and really implement workplace flexibility initiatives and methods in the federal workforce as well.
Tina, you have a wonderful perch sitting in the White House. Can you tell us what you see in terms of innovations as you talk to people around the country, and who should our listeners at Conversations on Healthcare be keeping an eye on?
Well, I think obviously you can't talk about innovation without talking about, you know, the internet and the web and the ability to communicate broadly with people through new media. It's something we spend a lot of time on here at the White House, and I think you are doing out there in the kinds of work that you all are doing. It is a great way to get information tailored to folks. It's a great way to have a conversation. There are terrific organizations like Moms Rising that are out there that are using the web. There's a great organization whose event I was just at in New York last week that the UN Foundation has started called Girl Up, which is going to use the internet and efforts to try to link girls in the U.S. to support their peers and girls around the world and really link girls here in the U.S. to the lives of girls around the world. Those innovations that are really linking us across boundaries, across cultures, I think is one of the really exciting things where we can help each other out.
Today, we've been speaking with Tina Chen, Executive Director of the White House Council on Women and Girls and White House Director for Public Engagement. Tina, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Margaret, and it was a pleasure to be with you.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a project that's leading the nation in making healthy food accessible to all Americans, the Food Trust Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative. Founded in 1992, the Food Trust has grown from providing small nutrition education classes for inner-city Philadelphia youth to taking an increasingly comprehensive approach to improving health food access across the state of Pennsylvania. In 2001, the Food Trust published a study titled "The Need for More Supermarkets," which reported that Philadelphia had the second lowest number of supermarkets per capita of major U.S. cities, and made the point that this poor food access was linked to the high incidence of obesity, diabetes, and other diet-related diseases in the city's low-income neighborhoods. These findings spurred the Pennsylvania legislature to create the Fresh Food Financing Initiative, a grant and loan program that's designed to promote supermarket development in underserved neighborhoods. The initiative works by providing the financing in the form of startup capital and credit to supermarket operators that traditional financial institutions in low-income neighborhoods can't or won't supply. In the initiative's first 3 years, the state of Pennsylvania invested $30 million into the project, and the reinvestment fund allocated $90 million more to set up an endowment. By the end of 2009, The initiative had financed 83 supermarket projects in 34 Pennsylvania counties, creating 5,000 jobs and over 1.6 million square feet of food retail. These tremendous successes have thrust the initiative into the national spotlight, and it's now being studied by both the Institute of Medicine and the National Institute of Health. And most recently, the Pennsylvania Initiative served as a model for President Obama's National Healthy Food Financing Initiative, which will provide similar supermarket financing across the country. Interested listeners can visit www.thefoodtrust.org for more information. By assisting supermarket operators in opening stores in underserved neighborhoods, the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative is helping to make healthy food available to more and more Americans and reducing their risk for diet-related diseases like obesity and diabetes. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.